Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
I am the proud owner of a couple of AIR awards. That's the now defunct Achievement in Radio.
I've got a couple of those.
Yeah, well, actually, I have them now.
Oh, you have them?
Yeah.
You took mine?
I think you gave them to me when you cleaned out your office in 96 or whatever.
I thought I had something like that.
If you want it, I can bring it back.
So I just wanted to tell that story because I was excited.
Yeah, we're very happy. We love PTI, obviously.
And the whole PTI. And then
thing.
I thought of all the people that I wanted to say eat it to. You know, and I'm
well, that's why you win.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
Actually live and plausibly live at the same time because we're alive when we do this. The show is on the air from Chatter, a bar and restaurant of consequence in the District of Columbia on the corner of Wisconsin Avenue Northwest and Jennifer Street Northwest. We're open all the time. We're open for breakfast starting at 8 o'clock in the morning. Come by. We have gifts for people when they come by if they buy food. We're not just throwing these things away. You got to buy some food.
May I ask you, I should have done this before we went on air. I move this over here and just bring it to you as you want it?
No, just give it to me. This is water for those people not watching.
It's your very full
it's water
and cup of water, Gary, which is perilously close to my left
That's Gary
elbow.
Braun, Howard Fineman, 3DP, the intergalactic
Doctor,
editor
Professor.
Of the Huffington Post is with us. Michael
now the Huff Post, by the way, not Huffington.
HP.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, we officially changed
Why?
The name.
Well, why is everything
efficient.
Being short?
It's fewer syllables.
That's like with a podcast. It becomes a pod.
You should take it to HP in honor of Carly Fiorina.
Well, HP is Hewlett Packard.
We have a new editor-in-chief now. Ariane Huffington's long gone.
She is?
Yes.
What happened to her?
She went off to do another startup. That's her favorite thing, is starting new things. So we have an editor named Lydia Paul Green from the New York Times. And she's very good.
So why don't you change it to the Fineman Post?
Well, I suggested
that. I mean, if Ariana Huffington's gone, why do you keep it Huff Post?
Because I've been there for a while, you know, next up, next in line.
Sure.
But it's now Huff Post.
Okay, that's great to know.
Yeah, I'm sure it's important to you.
Michael Kornheiser is here. Michael's going to do the news today because although Nigel is sitting here right
Upgrade.
Now, Nigel has a doctor's appointment in a little while, and Claude is going to run the board.
Doing a great
Michael's
job so far.
So we have all of these things in play. And
this
now
is the Wally Pipp moment.
Let me get to
Thursday show, people.
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
Yeah. So I got warned last night. I had dinner. I'll talk about
later. This isn't a prestigious show that I'm on today?
No, it's the Thursday show.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Now I get it.
It's the Thursday show.
Why I'm here.
Yeah. So I got warned last night. I'll talk about this in greater detail later about a dinner I had with Jay Rothman, who is the producer of Monday Night Football and for whom I worked for a number of years and who I like very, very much. And he had started listening to the podcast. And he said, you just can't go the first 30 minutes local. You got to do some national stuff. And so I am buoyed, as they say, by the fact that on the Overnight Sports Center, the first two stories, which got a lot of play, involved Washington teams. They involved the Washington Capitals, and they involved the Washington Wizards. And I'm going to start with the Capitals. Howard, who is from Pittsburgh and has every right to be delighted at the success of the Pittsburgh Penguins over a long period of time, going back to Mario Lemieux, Howard is wearing a Pittsburgh Penguins T-shirt today with a C on it. What's the C for?
It's Captain. Crosby.
Oh, Crosby. It's
Sid
Crosby.
The Kid.
Crosby on the back. All right. And why don't you, before I even start, why don't you explain why you would take this opportunity in the adopted hometown of your life for the last 30 or 40 years to rub salt in that wound? Why don't you explain that?
Well, basically, I'm a jerk. As is clear. Well, I wasn't going to do that. I thought a lot about what I would wear today, and
why did you think there'd be a photo shoot?
No, because GQ? I knew you'd react.
Yeah,
you know, I knew you'd react. So, what kind of reaction?
I hoped you'd wear the classics T-shirt.
I considered that, but here's the thing: when they hit Crosby late in the third period, and it was semi cheap shot, and everybody in the arena started cheering. I said, okay, to heck with it. I'm wearing the Crosby shirt.
I would.
Because Sidney Crosby, who my friends here in town call Cindy Crosby.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I hadn't heard that
right.
one.
Yeah, Cindy Crosby. He got pounded in this series.
They did. Got a concussion.
He got a concussion. He came back from the concussion, I think, one
too
game
early.
Game too early.
I think so, too.
And Sullivan made the coach of the Penguins made a big mistake putting him in game five for both tactical and medical reasons, in my humble opinion.
He is a doctor. He's
a
3DP.
That's very good.
He's a doctor.
Should be pointed out.
Yeah.
Dr. Howard.
All right. So that notwithstanding, and Crosby got crashed into the boards. He got knocked around. I mean, everybody on the Penguins was probably worried that, you know, he could, his skull could end up looking like an egg getting cracked on the side of a frying pan. He nevertheless powered through, had a beautiful, beautiful, was involved in the first goal,
yeah,
which was a picture-perfect passing goal that Crosby initiated. And he toughed it out, and the Penguins won, and Alexander Ovechkin didn't. And I was trying to think of a way to combine the Russia story, which I'm spending a lot of time on in my real life, and the Penguins, and I realized that it was staring me in the face, which is that Alexander Ovechkin was placed here by Vladimir Putin.
Hockey player himself.
Yes.
Yeah, also
big
a hockey
time.
Player.
Appeared
in a big charity game last night, scored seven goals.
Seven goals.
Which by his standards
nothing.
Is nothing.
Right. No.
And
he's the Kim Jong-un of hockey.
He is. So Ovechkin was placed here to demoralize...
And destabilize.
And yeah. Destabilize.
It's a great word, destabilize.
Destabilize the emotions of the leaders of the free world here in Washington, D.C. So it's clearly all tied together.
Yeah, there is some Russian influence joke.
Definitely.
Last night.
Yes.
Lack of Russian influence.
I would say this about the people who cheered last night as Sidney Crosby got hit. That if you polled them and you made it a secret poll and you said, would you rather have Crosby or Ovechkin? Over 85% would say I'd rather have Crosby, and maybe higher than that. Because here's what happened, and I'm going to say this as somebody, like, I invented the phrase choking dogs. That's mine.
Literally.
Do you have that
I do
slogan
not have
mark?
It. I do
mark?
Not. I do not. But it's mine. So
before that, the dog would just
Boz
die.
Boz can't use it, you know, yeah. And the cheese boy can't use it.
Right, because it's
Sally
identified with you.
It.
Like
no,
the bandwagon, right? It's identified
it's mine.
With you.
It's yeah. mine. Yeah. And so you would expect me to say today that they choked, and I don't think they did. And I'm going to tell you why I don't think they choked. They lost to the Penguins again. They are now 0-4 all-time in Game 7s with the Penguins, 0-3 at home. And Ovechkin is 0-3 against Crosby. So this is not ancient history. This is recent history. But the Pittsburgh Penguins are the number one. They were the Stanley Cup champions. They continue to be the reigning Stanley Cup champions. The Capitals were the number one team in all of the NHL this year, but the Penguins were number two. And the Capitals came back from 3-1 after losing two at home. They came back from 3-1 to tie the series at 3-3. And they lost Game 7. That doesn't, to me, that doesn't qualify as a choke. That's a loss. That's not a choke. This wasn't 5-0 at home like it was against the Rangers. Gary's looking at me very skeptically.
I don't even know you anymore.
I don't
finish. Go ahead.
I just
finish.
Don't think it's a choke. Now, you can line these things up. The Ovechkin part is bad. Because he lost to Crosby again, and he can't get past the second round again, and he lost at home again, and he didn't clear the puck on the second goal and was blamed on national TV by Barry Melrose. And Barry Melrose said afterwards, I would trade him. Yeah. I would consider trading him, that it is good for Ovechkin to be moved. It is good for the Capitals to move Ovechkin. He's
well,
a three-time...
Trotz clearly blamed him.
I felt Trotz did blame
him. He hung
him
out to dry.
I will say
night.
This about Barry Trotz. So everybody knows where my positioning is on this. Barry Trotz came to the city 2 years ago, or is it 3 years ago now? How many seasons has he been here? Two or three?
Three.
Okay. In two of those years, and Barry Trotz came here, and the people in town wrote about him as if he was the greatest coach in the history of the world. And if you look up his record, you will find that he, too, like Alexander Ovechkin, has never been to the conference final.
That was as far as he's been last night,
he's
right?
never been to the conference final. He's a second round and out guy.
Which the Nashville Predators now are in.
Right. So he left the team.
Good point.
He left the team, and in short order, they get to the conference finals without him. So let's not just blame Ovechkin here. Did Barry Trotz make what appeared to be a great move by demoting Ovechkin and saying it wasn't a demotion? Yes, he did. For two games, that worked great. Did it work great in that seventh game? No. So I'm not... All of these things to me in concert indicate to me that this is not a choke. They got beat by a really good team, a team that beats them a lot. And I don't know. So, Gary, you think it's a choke.
Well,
I think it's terribly disappointing because I thought they would win. And they are 2 years in a row the number one team in the NHL, and they can't get out of their own shadow. But this one didn't feel like a choke to
well,
me.
Well, all right. Without getting into the merits of whether or not it was a choke, would you give me a laydown? Would you give me a – this team came out, and they threw everything they had at it for about 5 minutes. And when it appeared that it was going to be hard, They basically said, maybe it's just not in the cards for us.
I watched a bunch of action in the second period where they completely dominated. They had a bunch of shots. They missed the shots.
Stretches in the second. But yeah, the third period, which I'm going to assume you were asleep for and you were awake as I point to Tony and Howard, respectively.
They gave up.
The third period, Tony, they had six shots on goal.
That's not good.
They ended the period down one goal at home. I mean, you can say to lose to the defending champ, which is a tremendous, tremendous team, and the Penguins is in and of itself not a choke. To lose a series that you are down 3-1 isn't a choke, however you get there. But as good as the team was, with all the expectations they had, with all the "this team is different" talk that we had,
wasn't different,
including dozens of texts from Sands up until about the third period of last night.
Sands going insane.
It's just awful. It's just, I told my kids last night. I said, they're going to break your heart, kids.
Wilbon cannot stand Ovechkin. You know, said so publicly.
I'm a little softer on Ovechkin. I mean, I saw what you guys saw last night, but this is not golf. It's not tennis. He's, you don't lose with one guy.
This will be a very obscure reference, but Ovechkin is the Dick Stewart of hockey.
That is a very obscure reference.
I don't get it.
Dr. Strange Glove. He was a first baseman for the Pirates,
who, when he hit a home run, hit it 550 feet.
Right.
And in a 10-4 game?
Yeah, and then couldn't field, couldn't play defense. Yeah. I mean, the second soul-crushing goal that the Penguins scored last night was directly due to Alexander Ovechkin, who didn't clear
the
puck.
Well, yeah, that's right.
To go to your point about Trotz, he was on the third line. That line gave up. That team gave up both goals.
In the third period, he did skate with Oshie and Backstrom some. So I think he was maybe double shifting him, or mixing it around, or he was just trying whatever he could do.
But he was, according to the paper, he had the seventh amount of ice time forwards.
Right. So. The team reminds me of the Dallas Maverick teams of maybe 12 or 15 years ago, or even the Indianapolis Colts teams before Peyton Manning actually broke through, like these teams that are just like prolific offensively, dominate regular seasons as those teams did, and just could never do anything in the postseason. This was the last shot. I mean, they're gonna bust.
I think you're right. I think that this probably was the last shot. Alexander Ovechkin has gone through a lot of coaches. He went through Boudreau, and he went through Hunter, and he went through Adam Oates. And the way that Trotz reacted to questions about Alexander Ovechkin indicates to me that he could go through Trotz too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know at this point what they're going to do. The Wizards, to make a bad night worse, the Wizards got crushed. They lost by 22 points. They were in Boston. They played no defense. The Celtics shot over 50%, which is really a high percentage, and most of them appeared to be right at the rim. Most of them appeared to be breakaways. You know, they were just not being guarded. The home teams all year long, when Boston and Washington play, the home teams are 9-0. And I had thought you couldn't win unless Isaiah Thomas had a big night. He got 18. Al Horford got 19. Avery Bradley got 29. So I was wrong about this. And yet I still feel that Washington is going to win that series. I still feel they are demonstrably better, though you can't prove it by last night.
That's exactly what you said about the Caps.
I did. So I end up being like a cheerleader and a
fanboy. So you can't win 1-2 or 5, but you'll go in there in game 7 and win?
And you think that's crazy?
I just haven't seen anything to suggest that it's going to happen.
I saw something on Twitter last night that totaled up all of the chances the Washington teams have had in playoffs in the last 20 years.
Well, there haven't been any champions, so it can't be good.
Like 3-80 or something.
Yeah, it can't be good.
Yeah,
Shockingly bad. So all that optimism of yesterday turns into all the pessimism of today.
And Luke had it.
It's a dreary.
Yeah, it's a rainy day. Luke was right.
Luke called it. He said they would both lose.
Yeah. And Luke was up in Boston for that.
Right.
So, all right, we will take a break. This is depressing. I've got to stop. We will take a break. When we come back, we will talk to Howard about the other big news in the country, you know, the whole country, the firing of James Comey and stuff like that. I am Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
So we'll do the MeUndies ad. Another one of the things that Rothman told me as he's now listening to the podcast was that I'm just sort of reading these things and I'm not selling it the way he wants me to sell it, which I didn't know he was a consultant on how to sell underpants.
You got to be you, Tone.
But MeUndies.
Caps are going to cap. Tony's going to tell.
Yeah, I mean, Michael's got them. Gary's got them.
Love MeUndies.
Nigel, you've got them. Elevate your underwear game to the next level with MeUndies. You've perfected your wardrobe, but what about the stuff not everybody gets to see? If you've been settling for store-bought, that is so hard to say, store-bought underwear five packs. Try to say that five times in a row. I have something that will change your life for the better, and that is MeUndies. What is the first thing you put on? The last thing you take off? It's your underwear. Make your most important piece of clothing the best it can be with MeUndies. It takes a little while to convince yourself that selling underpants is a good career move. I mean, I'm there now, but it took a little while.
Captain,
what are
underpants?
MeUndies? Just seriously soft, feel-good undies delivered right to your door. They're designed in Los Angeles. They're made from sustainably sourced micro-modal, a fabric three times softer than cotton. They are very, very soft. They're softer than soft. Luxe undies come in an ever-changing selection of classic colors, bold shades, and adventurous patterns. Quite adventurous. So you can tailor your undies to your own personal style. And guess what? You can save time and money each month with a monthly subscription. If you're not ready for that subscription, it's okay. You can still save. And that is because MeUndies is going to offer you, people listening to this podcast, 20% off your first pair. Just use the special URL, MeUndies.com/TonyK. Get 20% off your first pair. So go ahead and revamp your underwear drawer. You deserve it. And once again, that's MeUndies, MeUndies.com/TonyK. MeUndies.com/TonyK.
Tony, can I just say that I'm fascinated by the fact that they brag about that they're designed in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I guess they think that is...
Like Boogie Nights or something?
It's very, it's sophisticated, it's hip, it's Los Angeles. I would think. I mean, if they would they brag about the fact that they were designed if they were in Pittsburgh or Kansas City?
No,
I doubt it.
No.
But L.A., it actually just says L.A., so it could be Lower Alabama. It could be Lower Alabama.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is music from Brett Wiskons. This is called Don't Be the One, and he writes, you played one of my songs last year, Side Stage. Here's some other ones if you want to give them a whirl. They're all co-written and produced by everyone's favorite Gamecock Mark Bryan from Hootie. I own the copyright to these songs under my publishing company, Mad Diamond Publishing. Both songs feature my friend Ann Valbo, and Don't Be the One actually hit number one at a station in Burlington, Wisconsin. Tony Romo, anyone? Last summer. Big shows for me this spring and summer include opening up for Taylor Hicks, who was an American Idol winner in Chicago, at the City Winery on May 18th, so that's next week, and 10-time platinum Trace Atkins on July 20th in Wabash, Indiana. Love the show, and you should check out my buddy Rod Morgan's pod, The Morgan You Know, as I'm confident he's primed to make waves on the scene. What kind of podcast do we think that is? I don't even know what it is. Hope it's not a podcast specifically directed to the Capitals and the Wizards.
Mark Bryan, Seneca Valley attendant.
Yeah. He got some pub yesterday on the same show that Stuffy was written.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure I played golf with him once or twice, and I liked him very much. Howard is here, and this is a great time to talk to Howard, as it was a great time yesterday to talk to Chuck Todd and Luke Russert. Howard's credentials in journalism are even better than his credentials in talking about the Pittsburgh Penguins. So we'll start.
That's not saying much, but that's okay.
We'll start with the Comey firing, because that's what everybody is starting with.
Yeah.
What is your sense of this in terms of the claims that he just wasn't very good and had politicized the office?
Well, it's true that Comey had politicized the office, even as he desperately tried not to politicize it. I mean, the great irony of James Comey's career is that he wanted to be a choir boy and be seen as a choir boy.
Right.
And then he got into what I would compare to the bad situation of an umpire who evens up. He makes one bad call and follows it up with another bad call and thinks that it comes out even.
Right.
It doesn't. It robs you of credibility as an umpire. And that's kind of what happened to him. However, I don't think those were in and of themselves firing offenses. And according to the statute that gives the FBI director a 10-year term, that wasn't really a firing offense. The reason he got fired is that he refused to play ball. And I'm not saying that he necessarily was being asked to cover up whatever there is to cover up about the Trump camp's relationship with Russia. It's that he made it clear to Donald Trump he wasn't going to be his boy in any sense. As a matter of fact, James Comey went in the opposite direction. For example, when Donald Trump kept insisting that the phones at Trump Tower were being tapped, Comey came out and
There's no evidence of
that. Well, he did the extraordinary thing for an FBI director of coming out and saying, you know what? There were no tapes. We have no evidence of that whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that was a stick in the eye of Donald Trump and a message to Donald Trump to lay off, to stay away while we're doing what we're doing. Which, in previous times, is what presidents, even Richard Nixon, would be careful not to be seen as doing, interfering in an FBI investigation. But Donald Trump doesn't play by any of those rules. And Trump does not know what he doesn't know about what the FBI investigation is looking into. And that's why Comey was fired.
So let me get to a couple of things. And one of the things that I saw on the news this morning, early this morning, was that associates of Comey said that at one point he actually said out loud that Trump may be crazy. Well, I mean, I don't think you want to hear that if you're the president from somebody you have the power to appoint and remove.
Right.
But I'm wondering, is the person behind this, is it Donald Trump in your mind, or is it Jeff Sessions in your mind? And because I think there's a difference there that may be, that distinction may be important.
No, it's Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump. And I think that Sessions probably urged Trump to do it. And even though Jeff Sessions, in theory, is recused from saying anything.
You don't believe that.
No, of course not.
Right. You don't believe that.
Of course not. Of course not. The disregard of legal niceties and the law here is just vast. So, yeah, I think Sessions might have said to Trump, you know, it's a bigger problem than you realize with Comey. We got to do something. And then Trump called them over and called Rod Rosenstein, the new deputy attorney general, over and said, you know, give me a memo that will justify firing Comey, okay, which Rosenstein did.
So let me get to this, because mm-hmm. this, and everyone will look at it this way. It seems like The Apprentice. It seems like Comey was one of the eight people on Apprentice, and Trump just turned to him and said, you're fired. You said something before that I think is important to talk about. You said that even Richard Nixon would have understood the sort of rules of the game where it went with the FBI.
Well, he would then violate them, but he'd understand them. Yeah.
But Trump is like no one we've ever seen in this job. Right. His background is dissimilar. His orientation towards how the country runs is dissimilar. He was probably elected on that. And he doesn't know any of this stuff. So all of the rules that people like you, when they cover, are used to people paying attention to, that's all out the window. It's every day. It's just different.
Well, it's one thing to be a populist outsider who's going to clean out the stables of Washington, D.C., which is a useful thing to do. And it's another thing to have contempt for all of the institutions prescribed by the Constitution to allow us to run a republic democracy, which is what we have. Trump's attitude towards the law as a former real estate developer in New York, and his regard for public institutions such as city councils and zoning directors and all that, is nothing but contemptuous. And
well, I think he says to himself,
contemptuous.
I think he looks at the world this way. I won. Get out of my way.
Right.
I mean, he clearly pays no attention to the Constitution or what he said yesterday.
Not to mention this naive antique point, but which he put his hand on a Bible right, to swear to uphold.
Right.
When you're president, when you get sworn in as president, you don't take an oath to protect the country and the fatherland or the motherland or whatever. You take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, which is a concept that is completely alien to Donald Trump.
So let me get to what I saw today.
Chances he's read that cover to cover?
Zero.
No. Okay. Well, I haven't either. Have you?
Well, you didn't swear to defend it.
Okay. But let me get to what I saw today on TV, because instead of Sean Spicer, Sarah Huckabee was on the Today Show, which is the show that I watch. Mm-hmm. And she was asked, I thought, the right question, which is, well, are you going to shut down the Russia investigation or is it going to continue? And she said, everything that was going on Monday is going on today. These things continue to go on. Do you believe that the Russia investigation will go on and that whoever is appointed will continue it? And is it something, truly something, that Donald Trump has to worry about?
Well, to go in reverse order, it's definitely something he has to worry about.
Him personally,
and
or
he's
his
definitely
people?
Worried about it.
Okay.
The way these things operate is that they work from the outside in, and they follow the money, to use the Watergate term. That phrase is relevant again in a different context. What the FBI is running is a counterintelligence investigation, which is not a criminal investigation necessarily. It's to find out basically whether treason has been committed, or, you know, what the penetration of the Russians actually was. But the timing of the Comey firing comes at the same time that
there's
what's
banging
going on
here. No, there's banging. There's it's ambient noise. There's construction.
There's some construction upstairs.
Yeah. Yeah,
trying to keep you dry.
Actually, it's the Russians putting in a bug here.
Yeah, or a hockey rink, so Putin can come play.
So this happened at the time that Comey had just asked for a substantial increase in funding,
right,
for the Russia probe, and at a time that a grand jury that had been quietly impaneled in the Eastern District of Virginia was beginning to issue subpoenas. And I think what Trump is worried about is that the FBI is going to use the criminal investigation to follow the money to get people, perhaps, I'm just guessing here, like Mike Flynn on the money, Paul Manafort on the money, Carter Page on the money.
But these people have all sort of been, if not disgraced, they've been taken down already
publicly.
Yeah, but
that's not the point. The point is that if they didn't report the money that they got,
right,
from wherever,
as consultants,
if they didn't register as foreign agents, which they should have, the FBI, in theory now, can get some of these people on criminal charges and then squeeze them for what they might know about the counterintelligence probe.
Donald Trump said the other day that he thanked James Comey for three specific times, telling him he is not the object of this investigation. Do you believe that to be true?
Well, first of all, that revealed...
And why would James Comey tell him that?
Well, first of all, there's no evidence of that. And I don't know where Donald Trump got that, and they haven't, at the White House, put out any additional information.
Oh, okay.
So we don't know whether that was said. And by the way, even if Comey had said that, that doesn't mean anything at this point. No, the president is not the target. And by the way, both to the extent that anybody can say definitively, which is James Clapper, who knows about the other 15 agencies that are part of something called the community is a term of art for the 16 intelligence agencies in the United States, which includes the CIA, the NSA, and part of the FBI. Most of the FBI is domestic, not foreign, but the FBI also does these counterintelligence investigations.
Okay.
Clapper said, I can say for sure that Donald Trump is not, this isn't about Trump, there's no evidence of collusion involving Donald Trump or anything like that. He can't speak and did not speak for what the FBI is doing. And he said that publicly, and that left open in Donald Trump's mind, and in fact, the FBI investigation. And Trump is very, very worried. There's no question that he's worried about it. When he puts that in the firing letter, that you've told me I'm clean.
Right.
I mean, that sounds like a Macbeth moment. You know, what else? How else are you supposed to interpret that?
Do you think that ultimately this investigation will be left in the hands of the FBI regardless of who replaces James Comey? Or do you think that ultimately there will be something like a special investigation that has nothing, that doesn't just stop with the director of the FBI?
Well, that depends on Republicans in Congress. Jeff Sessions and the president are the two people under the current statute who have the authority to name a special prosecutor.
They're not going to do that.
They're not going to do it.
Right. They're not going to do
it. And so far, the key guy, Mitch McConnell in the Senate, the Republican in the Senate from Kentucky, who I've covered since the 70s, is sticking with the president. He's saying, you know, let's just get a new FBI director. Let's move on. Let's not worry about it. Let's let the Senate do its business.
So great. It's like an athlete says, yeah, that happened, but I've moved on.
Yeah, I've moved
so
on.
Don't ask me about
not
that
here to
ever
talk about
again.
The past.
And McConnell is shrewdly making an appeal to the institutional vanity of the Senate and saying, you know, we have a great investigation going on headed by Richard Burr of North Carolina and Mark Warner of Virginia. Let's let them
Who are both very upset about this firing.
Yes, they're very upset about it. And, but Burr has not called. Burr wants to run his investigation. He wants to be Sam Ervin, or who knows what he wants. And McConnell is not yet ready to distance himself from Donald Trump. Now, my friend E.J. Dionne wrote in the Post this morning, fatal mistake by Mitch McConnell. Well, that's what the Democrat is going to say. And I know McConnell, and he is the exquisitely exact weather vane of what will sell to Republican constituencies. And he knows that from Kentucky, where he built the machine that he runs to this day. And he knows it from having run the Senate campaign committee. He knows it from doling out money to everybody. He's not ready to cut and run yet. But the moment that Mitch McConnell or a critical mass of Republican senators say we need a special prosecutor, then the political pressure on Trump and Sessions to do it will be irresistible. And I don't know when that moment comes. I think it will come.
I'll get you out of here on this.
Yeah.
Do you think right now, in private conversations and little private rooms, Republican senators are in fact talking to each other about, we got to get out of this thing?
I don't think there's any question about it. Yeah. It's in the once it's in the cloakroom, it's probably going to get there. Right now, Donald Trump is being the new element here in the conversation. And it was alluded to by that quote in the paper about Comey. People are wondering if Trump is stable. In other words, he's yelling at the television set whenever he sees Comey. There's a lot of reporting to that.
I usually just yell at Ovechkin.
Okay, so he's being viewed. And
this picture of him storming around enraged in front
of
his television.
Even worse, and the sort of to mix metaphors in the blood and the water situation here, they think he's hopelessly incompetent. The fact that the White House couldn't get its story straight on why they fired Comey is seen as a sign of hopeless weakness and amateurism. So aside from the legal substance, the Republican senators are saying, why? Forget that what he did might be illegal. It's that he's not competent enough to spin it properly.
It's fantastic.
And if you can't spin it, get out of town.
It's fantastic.
Get out of town.
It's like the beginning of American Idol, where all the pros look and an amateur comes up and wins, and that becomes more important than the pros.
You can't play this game. Yeah.
Let's get out of here. We will come back with news. Michael Kornheiser will do the news when we return. I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find qualified and quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Tony. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Tony. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Tony.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the local group, Jake Flack and the Rhodes Tavern Troubadours. The song is called The Red Line Train. That may be one that's on fire at the moment. As the Metro spends every day starting fires and then putting out fires.
But there are fewer fires.
Fewer fires this year. We like this group.
Really slow song for if you're singing about the Red Line.
For the Metro, because it's so slow.
It's bluesy. Bluesy.
So we have a big crowd for breakfast here at Chatter. Makes me very, very happy. We're open at 8 in the morning for that. And we have all sorts of innovations, as Nigel had to leave us for the day, and Claude is here. And so Nigel can't do news, and Michael will do the news. Starting with, I would think, and as the rain beats down on us, it would not be appropriate for the Nats to play in this. But you went to the Nats game last night, the third game of a four-game, two-city
A home and home.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I heard that last night was going to be the biggest night in D.C. sports history.
Right.
So I went out and I bought up tickets to the Nats game.
Yeah.
Nothing like May baseball, as Kevin Sheehan told me yesterday when we finished up on the golf course. So the Nats finally, excuse me, got a win off of the Orioles. Again, these are the two best teams in baseball currently playing against each other in what I like to call the Masson rivalry game,
yes,
where we're just clawing our way back for some of that Masson money.
Yeah.
Got off to a rocky start. Strasburg on the mound. Cool evening. Air maybe a little bit heavy coming in off of the river.
Not sunny at 75.
He gives up a shot in the top of the first to the first batter. Michael A. Taylor misplays it. It goes off of his glove, and we have no outs, runner on second.
Okay.
Nats get out of a few jams in the early innings. Strasburg throws a lot of early pitches. Nats are down early.
Down a lot.
Down a lot. Have a few scoring chances.
5-0, right?
It was 3-0. Then Michael A. Taylor slowly started to bring them back with a runner on third. I believe he had a single, and he actually finished the night with, I believe, 4 or 3 RBI.
He had a home run later in the game.
He had the home run as I was getting into my Uber to try and catch the end of the other historic losses.
So you didn't stay for the
He's
finale.
A colonizer. What do you think?
To be fair, I had a friend at the Baltimore series who had to drive back to Baltimore.
Okay.
And I wanted to make sure she could get on the road.
Okay.
At a reasonable time. So yes, I heard the Michael A. Taylor home run, which is the best you can ever hope for with him at the plate.
Right.
So we get to the ninth inning, and we have Jason Worth doing what he does best, which is work those long at bats with a lot of foul pitches, fouls off the bat, and he hits a home run. And we have Harper, Murphy doing what they do. Zimmerman seems to revert to form a little bit, out. And we actually have the former Oriole himself with the walk-off win.
Matt Wieters.
To just really finish off that D.C. winning night.
So, but I just want to make sure of something. The Nats scored 5 runs in the 8th and the 9th inning,
right,
including the winning runs, and you saw none of them.
Well, I heard them.
Okay. Okay, well, that's just...
You have to use all of your senses when you were
all
watching.
All 5 of those senses.
And
your
listening.
Boy Blake Trinan got in there, giving up one earned and a couple of
but I liked the description of the heavy air coming off the river. That was excellent.
It was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But they won. They finally won a game. So what would have been the worst night in D.C. sports was not the worst night.
Well, some were saying it was even worse that the Nats did end up winning this game late.
Really?
Well, they just did sort of rub salt in the wound.
I don't know. It felt good. It gave you something.
They got to the Baltimore bullpen in the way that Baltimore has gotten to the Nats bullpen.
And cool to see Wieters get it.
I didn't expect them to win that game because when I stopped watching, I think it was like 5-0 or 5 or something like that. Strasburg was not effective at all, and the Nats had done nothing.
Yeah, but Miley ended up throwing a lot of pitches, so they had to go to the bullpen earlier than they would have wanted.
Was it a big crowd, or was the crowd held down by the other two games being on television?
Announced attendance of just under 33,000. That's a
it was
crowd.
Much
32,984.
Yeah, it was a larger crowd than I would have expected. You have a population of what I'd call older baseball fans that just enjoy the experience of walking the concourse.
Tracy Roberts told me it looked like Gaulers. Tracy said it was the oldest crowd she had ever seen in her life. She was working the game.
I have a feeling that 20 of those 30-some-odd thousand people did not know that the Wizards were playing, and everyone else was checking the cap score on their phones. And an interesting move, the Nats PR team only put the period scores at the end of every break up on the Jumbotron rather than giving you some live feed, which I would have preferred throughout the game.
Well, this day and age, I'm sure people were just watching the game on their phones and stuff, whichever game
they I do think it's nice, though, that Well, I thought it was okay that they won that game.
I was buoyed by it, yes, because it had been
I'm not
it was
sure
a
they're
going
to play tonight. I'm not sure, because this rain is
with
supposed
AJ
to be
With A.J. Cole scheduled to pitch, I think that would be a good move.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they're going to play that game tonight. Well, okay, so that's not a bad crowd. I think you buried the lead, though. You said when you got off the golf course with Kevin Sheehan?
Yeah, well, I had a business meeting.
Oh, could you wonder, how did that work out?
I struggled on the front nine. I came back. I shot even par in the back. I birdied 18, which is a really good birdie. And Kevin was just ribbing me the entire way that I would choose May baseball searching after that pennant instead of supporting my other D.C. sports teams, which, you know, I did in my own way.
I thought you did. I mean, that's okay. How did Kevin play? Kevin hits it off the tee pretty well.
He struggled. He was struggling a lot with his wedges. I want him to start using the orange whip training aid to try and get a little bit more rhythm and balance to his swing.
Okay.
We had fun.
What else do we have in news?
How about this for a headline? Bambi's revenge, deer photographed nibbling on human bones. A first. Well, hopefully a first.
Well, hopefully a last. I mean, we don't want this to
animal revolution.
Yeah.
Depends on, you know,
deer are eating people now.
Yes, deer have been spotted eating meat and gnawing on bones before, but not this kind of bones. The body from which these bones came was placed with the highest scientific goals in mind on the floor of that forest, which is better known as the Forensic Anthropology Research Facility in San Marco, Texas.
Wait, so let me understand. Scientists are looking to see if deer will eat humans by deliberately placing dead human bones out there, why?
In my understanding, the purpose of the research is to study how bodies decompose, what scavengers may interact with a decomposing
usually
body.
Usually they're placed in a cage.
Yeah, they're not trying to railroad the deer.
Who designed this study? Hannibal Lecter?
Yeah, that's
no, this stuff goes on in the name of science. There's this.
But you don't want to influence deer to pick up a taste of humans.
Now that they've had a taste of human flesh, they're going to go...
Well, isn't that how it works?
Isn't that how it works?
It's an innocent scientific study in Texas.
Results in something terrible.
Results in deer planet.
Right, yeah, you don't want that.
Planet of the deer.
This particular body, which researchers deposited in 2014, was initially stripped by vultures.
Well, that's what they do.
Then, the following January, a remote camera snaps shots of a new visitor to the scene, a young white-tailed deer. Not outside the little house, I guess. It looked very dainty, but for the human rib bone extending from the side of the mouth like a cigar.
Yeah, so you don't want them coming into even a place like Chatter and ordering the ribs.
You talk about the decaying carcass all the time of certain family athletes.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Well, looks like these ribs were slow cooked over a couple years. Maybe a little dizzy dust.
Bambi chainsaw massacre.
Yeah, what else?
How about this? Journalists arrested for aggressively questioning U.S. official. I'll have to turn to the two journalists in this room.
Only one. Howard's the only one. I'm now.
You did a lot of investigating for those columnettes.
Yeah, a lot.
Police in West Virginia's capital arrested a journalist who they said was trying aggressively to get past Secret Service agents and yelling questions at U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. Daniel Ralph Amon, 54, who is based in Charleston and works for the Independent Public News Service, was charged with willful disruption of governmental process, a misdemeanor, and later was released on a $5,000 bond. What do you think it means to be aggressively questioning in this instance?
I just think it means you see somebody who you know is the subject of a tremendous amount of news and you cannot get to him or her. So you yell at them. This is what happens whenever the presidents go into the helicopter.
Yeah. Right.
People yell and yell and yell. I've never heard, Howard, of anyone being arrested for something
I've also never heard of a
misdemeanor or whatever called willful disruption of governmental process.
Yeah.
Yeah. When are they going to take Congress down on that?
Yeah, exactly. Good one, Gary. Good one, Gary. I mean, Andrea Mitchell would be in jail for life if this applied here.
Sure, that's crazy.
I mean, what she does is she... Because they won't give her an interview, she yells to Lavrov and Trump just the other day.
That's what you're supposed to do.
That's what you're supposed to do.
That's actually the job.
And I've actually had very prominent people not want to have me. I'm sure they'd like to have me arrested, but all they do is stop talking to me when I yell at them.
Very odd. That's an odd circumstance. What else? Anything else?
Yeah, Katz's Deli, the 129-year-old pastrami palace on New York's Lower East Side, is looking to expand. And wouldn't you know, D.C. might be on that list.
Okay, so now I'm going to attack this with a vigor unknown in Western civilization. Because this has happened.
This is the choking dog's rant.
This has happened before. I remember 10, 15 years ago, maybe more than that.
Carnegie.
The Carnegie Deli, which is most famous in the Woody Allen movie. I've forgotten the name
of the
movie. Annie Hall? No, it's not Annie Hall. It's one of the other movies.
Manhattan?
It's a movie. It's a movie.
They're all the same.
Hannah and her sisters. Right.
It's not Hannah and her sisters. It doesn't matter.
Blue Diamond.
It's not that.
What was that?
No, I will.
Blue Nile.
No, it's not that. And right. Stop shouting.
Okay.
So okay.
Aggressively questioning is what I consider it.
Someone put him in jail for $5,000 bond. Carnegie Deli is a great deli. They moved to Washington, and it failed miserably. Why did it fail miserably? Well, one of the reasons was that the bread wasn't the same, and the cooking apparatus wasn't the same, and the taste wasn't the same, and the cry for such things wasn't the same, and they were out and gone probably in 3 years, Howard, the Carnegie Deli. That's probably what happened. There's a very famous, in the theater district in New York, very famous Italian restaurant, Carmine's, which is just jammed to the gills between 5:30 and 7:30, and then if you go at 8 when the curtain goes up, you can get a table and you can eat there. And Carmine's is here, and I don't think it's succeeding at all. I don't think it is. I don't think you can transplant tastes quite like this. And I think Katz's Deli, I don't know how you feel. I think it will not work. I think it will not
work. One of the things that struck me when I came to Washington was what a deli desert this is. And there is something about, this is the South still, ostensibly. Yeah. Yeah. Or whatever it is, it's... Delis don't grow in this soil.
It's not. It just it's, it doesn't.
D.C. does not. Bread. It does not need bread. A Katz. It needs, excuse me, the corner bodega, which is, I believe, what you're really thinking that you see in this sort of downtown desert. There is no place to get just a sandwich, a normal sandwich, a breakfast sandwich. So I wish it luck. If you look at the Shake Shack popularity for the last 10 years, it seems that we've just been the trickle-down effect for every eatery coming out of the New York area.
I think Tony has the right point here, which is there's no infrastructure here for it.
The food's not the same. The bread's not the
bread,
same.
The meat, that everything.
It's why you can't transplant pizza.
Don't they ship the water down here or something for bagels?
You mean New York-style
pizza? It doesn't
pizza?
Work. No, I just mean pizza. It doesn't work. The ovens, it's just, it doesn't.
No, you're right.
It doesn't work. It'll be extraordinarily successful for a year. And then within 3 years, it'll close up. I mean, it's just the way it goes. And Katz's is a big deal, but it's not a bigger...
Yeah, institution.
Which is the movie with the Carnegie Deli in it? It's the movie...
I'll find it out.
He's with Mia Farrow. They're out in New Jersey. There's a kidnapping. It's a black and white... Well, many of the movies are black and white movies, but it's the one that's set in New Jersey. And it's the one where he goes, it's a Travis Shamockery. That's the movie with the Carnegie Deli in it. Because the Carnegie Deli opens the movie, they got comedians in there, and they're talking about the character played by Woody Allen, he was an agent for like ridiculous acts, like people who had cockatiels playing water glasses.
Broadway Danny Rose.
Bang! Broadway Danny Rose, that's the movie. We will take a break. We'll come back with Old Guy Radio. I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is the SeatGeek ad. SeatGeek probably did great business yesterday with anybody who was a fan of any of the teams in Washington because the Nats played and the Caps played and the Wizards played.
A lot of Orioles fans down at Nats Park.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, when you watch the games at Orioles Park, there's a lot of Nats fans. I mean, it's 40 minutes. It's not that big a deal. Buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but there's a better, simpler way to buy, and that is with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just two taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. SeatGeek will save you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to help you get the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed. You can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. We are urging you to make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. And best of all, listeners to this high-quality podcast, or pod, as the kids say, they get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get that, download the SeatGeek app, SeatGeek, the SeatGeek app, and enter the promo code Tony today. That is promo code 20, Tony rather, for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Old Guy Radio for the day. This is a Sam Cooke song covered by Eric Burdon and the Animals. Actually, they were just the Animals then. Eric Burdon's 76 years old today. Eric Burdon is one of the greatest singers of all time in blues and rock and roll. When he was with the Animals, he was spectacular, spectacular. When he went off with the group War, he was terrible. He was a fat, long-haired, leaping gnome by his own account at that point. And I have no idea what happened, but this guy... this guy could sing. House of the Rising Sun. This the first two or three Animals albums are spectacular for him. Don't you think, Howard?
The classics butchered every one of Eric Burdon's. No, the Animals were they were fantastic. And you have to understand the context of the times, in that everything was still a little white bread and
not them.
They were passionate beyond.
They were not the Dave Clark Five.
Yeah, and passionate beyond the Stones. Also, they brought an emotion to rock and roll. It has to be called rock and roll in the 60s that you didn't just see great from any other white band.
They were just great. I think they were from Newcastle. I think that was their hometown.
They were fantastic.
We would ask Nigel, but Nigel is having multiple surgeries at the moment, so he's not with us. I should never do this to my son because I love my son. I think I stopped him from one news story, and I'd like him to get to that.
Well, no, it's okay. A lot of people email that they don't like when I go into spin rates and all the insider golf stuff, so we can shelve this story if you want,
or
we can tee it high and let it fly.
I love when you do that.
Let it fly.
As a non-golfer, I love listening to that.
So the big story in our sport was Rory McIlroy finally finalizing a deal.
Because Nike's out of the club business.
Nike's out of the club business.
So Tiger and Rory are free.
And Rory famously went on a driver search this offseason, which many people think led to some of those early season injuries from just all the trauma that his body sustained swinging over 120 miles an hour trying to crank out these drivers. So he was using the Callaway driver while he was a free agent, but now we see that he has gone with the front runner trying to close out some majors, and he is with TaylorMade through the bag, though he's still going to use his Callaway white-hot prototype putter. But apparently this all started from the desire to get a ball that would fly through the air more regularly with his correct spin rates and carry distances. Because when you're playing and you're going from mountain air to sea level to the Florida winds to the hot summer air, you want to be able to predict that number exactly. So he was trying everything out, and he is now going full TaylorMade. And then in the bigger news story, you saw that Adidas sold off TaylorMade pretty much after the biggest offseason signing, which just makes you wonder, is there any money left to be made in the golf hardware business?
So if you're Rory McIlroy and you have a contract with a particular club, and that club is then sold, is the new owner, I assume the new owner is obligated to pay you for that deal.
They buy the contracts.
Will the clubs as we know them that are called TaylorMade, will they continue to be built?
I would imagine so. They have been the number one club in golf for the last 10 or so years, particularly in the driver category, which is where most people are willing to spend the money. TaylorMade made the mistake when they were doing two releases per season with their drivers, because there just were not enough dollars to spread around. You might get someone to buy a new driver once every year, maybe once every 2 years, but when you're throwing out that much money into the launch every season twice, there's just not enough people to buy that. But you're buying, if you're this investment firm, you're just buying TaylorMade for all of the good publicity that they've collected with these independent players who have been contracted to other golf companies who have gone out and used TaylorMade drivers and woods because they think they're better or longer. And all these clubs are the same. They just have, you know, different specs with shafts that might work for one player slightly better.
The smartest thing that they've done in golf over the last 10 years, whoever figured this out is brilliant, change the color of each new release of the driver head. Change the color so that everybody knows, oh, yours is white.
Right.
Oh, you got that 4 years ago, because now everybody's using a different color. And so that sort of shames you into trying to buy new equipment.
You're outed.
I think that's smart.
Kevin using old technology on the driver, and it really showed yesterday.
It showed in the sense that he was terrible?
Yes. And this all started. TaylorMade did this with their 300 series in the early aughts, and they went from that famous burnt orange, which you would have liked.
With the bubble shaft.
Yeah, the bubble drivers, to a very calming metallic gray blue that they claimed science said was a more relaxing color when you would tee up, that it put you in a better frame of mind, which I think is probably fake science.
I think a picture of a deer eating a human bone on there.
Yeah, it takes the cake. Why can't John
just
Wall
put that
get a
on
club
there.
Deal?
Yeah.
That's what I wanted.
All right, so last night I had dinner with my old boss and producer of Monday Night Football, Jay Rothman, who had wanted to come down here and he wanted to see the studio and was very intrigued with the fact that I was a co-owner of a restaurant. I said, come on, why don't you come and I'll buy you dinner? And it was a series of texting back and forth. And the first one concluded with, you are buying, with a question mark. And I said, I am buying. And he said, then I want the best bottle of wine in the house. And I said, the best bottle of wine we have, you could purchase at a gas station. I'm happy to buy dinner. I should tell you, Jay Rothman, he has produced Monday Night Football. He produced Sunday Night Football for ESPN. And when Sunday night turned into Monday night, he continued to produce Monday Night Football. And he was my boss. And I don't know who the greatest bosses anybody has ever had in this particular room or who is even listening, but Jay Rothman was a great boss. He is a fanatically insane type A to the 23rd prime number. He's a workout monster. Everything he does, he attacks voraciously. Everything is done at a speed of light all the time, and I just couldn't believe, and I can't believe, he still does the job that he does, because that producing a football telecast is really hard. You're in a truck, you're looking at 20 different cameras. A director is calling shots that he wants, but a producer is in charge of influencing every single thing. He's talking in the ear of the talent, he's talking in the ear of the director, he's talking to all the people. He may probably not talking to camera people, but he might, if he wants to, talk to camera people. And it requires an inhuman energy, which Jay Rothman had. Somebody like that, you would say, well, I can't work for him because he's so crazy and I can never get his attention. And the contrary was completely true. Whenever I called him, no matter how small a point it was, if it was after a game and I was upset at something that happened in the game, something I said or something somebody else said, I could call him on the phone. He would give me his complete attention. If I went to see him, if we had meetings, before the meetings, if I went to see him, I would get his complete attention. And he was always incredibly sympathetic. And the great trick here is, so I'm working in a booth with Ron Jaworski and Mike Tirico. And it's not always the smoothest thing in the world. I mean, because it's hard to do these things. And I would say, this was awful. And he would be totally sympathetic. And within an hour, maybe Tirico or Jaws would say the same thing. And he'd be totally sympathetic to them. I mean, everybody felt that you could go to him on anything at any time. And he would be sympathetic. The trick in dealing with so-called talent is, you know, what are they worth, really? What are they worth? How much aggravation are they worth? What is their level of competence? And at what point do you say, I'm done? Well, they said it with me after 3 years. And I'm done. I'm done with this dope. And they brought in John Gruden. And I mean, and all of that stuff is fine. But I worked for a guy who, whenever I needed him, was there. Did you ever work for somebody like that?
First of all, I want to say that this podcast is run with an equal sense of drive and focus and energy. I mean,
it's nice of you to say. It's not true, but it's nice of you to say.
I guess so. I'm trying to think.
I mean, I've been very lucky in my businesses. I've had great bosses.
Yes.
I've had great editors. I was great to work for George Solomon. Right. It was great to work for Jeannie McManus. Going all the way back to Newsday, I worked for a guy named Dave Hamilton. I was completely in love with Dave Hamilton. He was great to work for. Working for Eric Rideholm is wonderful. You know, working now for myself in podcasts is good, although I had pretty good relationships with people in radio all the time.
Yeah, I would say the best working relationship I had was with John Meacham,
who at Newsweek.
Now the historian. He came in as a 25-year-old writer in the Nation section from Tennessee, and was just gifted beyond measure in doing whatever it is we did at Newsweek, which was what we call the first rough draft of history. Now he's a historian. But, you know, the junction between journalism, daily journalism, and history books was Newsweek or Time magazine. And he was just incredibly gifted, and we just developed an amazing relationship where he made me a better reporter, a better writer. The irony is I sort of trained him in a way, and then he took over and helped me. And that went on for many, many years. So he's the best editor I ever had.
Here's what you're looking for in a boss. Mm-hmm. You're looking for someone who you believe has confidence in you,
right,
who is not threatened by you,
right,
who is not always holding the sword of Damocles over your head, and who gets you to, when you do your work, you're going to do it better than you've ever done it before, almost because you feel an obligation to that person.
Absolutely. He wasn't my boss, actually, but I reported directly to the somebody above him. But as somebody who was a companion with me in doing what I do and was encouraging, but could tell me, this sucks when it sucks.
Yeah, you got to be able to say
it
that.
It was just, it was a once-in-a-lifetime thing, actually.
So, Gary, you are a boss.
I am, but I've also, as you know, from the early days in radio, had the benefit of some tremendous leadership at those radio stations early on. And you call Jay your boss, and maybe I'm wrong, but I would say technically he's not your boss as your producer. I mean, I can say I was your producer for a number of years, which people don't know, before I sat here with you on this show. And when you are producing someone, particularly in a broadcast environment, I mean, your job is to make that person as good as possible. I mean, it's kind of a thankless job in terms of the spotlight, you know? So you see this person in the spotlight who you're propping up, who you're trying to elevate, who you're making as good as possible. And for a producer, and I am a producer. I mean, I am my business now, but I produce most of what we generate. I'm fine with that. You know, I mean, it takes that personality, but it's a complete team effort. And when you have that relationship, you know, when there's a mutual respect, because I think particularly in the broadcast world, in TV broadcast, I won't point any fingers, but I would think it's quite possible that somebody who's camera front could have a little less respect for someone who's camera back. I mean, you think of some, I will point fingers, I guess, because he's an easy target right now, but like some Bill O'Reilly outtakes off the top of your head. And that was one thing, honestly, I mean, not to shine a light on you, but I mean, that was one great thing about working for you in that capacity. I mean, here you are talking about your producer as your boss. He probably in some ways felt like you were his boss.
No, he was great. He is great. He's great. He's absolutely great. Michael's been in an odd position. He's worked for his father-in-law and his father.
Can I also say the TV is different? I mean, I have enough experience in television in addition to print to know that the sort of ego demands and the pressure of people who are on the air is a special circumstance that producers have to be especially good at dealing with. Because when you're writing stories, yes, it's you and it's your being on the line, but it's one removed from actually being on the air and people seeing you and people reacting to you as a person. And to manage that kind of thing is very difficult. And I would also say that the people in NBC that I've dealt with are very good at that. I mean, you look at NBC and MSNBC, you've got a million big personalities there. You have to have the ability to deal with each one of them on their own basis.
I think this
it's
stuff
very
is
hard to do.
I've been very lucky. Let me go back to this, because who's better? Your father-in-law or your father?
This is a losing situation for me. I feel like I'm Matt Albers up here trying to save the game. No, it was a wonderful experience to work for and with my father-in-law, who had the amazing ability as a headmaster of a mid-sized boarding school to connect equally with high school kids, young professionals, older professionals, families, and do all this seamlessly within the day and connect with each person under his employ, whether it was a staff member working on the grounds or the most cantankerous old teacher that is notorious for being difficult, and giving that person what they need to succeed. And I never felt more excited to just talk about my career goals, to talk about the path that I was taking, and really to feel that he was not only guiding me, but sort of walking along that path with me, particularly when I was looking towards graduate school and what program I thought might fit where I wanted to be, where I still might want to be professionally.
Sure.
And in the more recent years, when I found myself looking at my current position, when I was a four-section classroom teacher, trying to think, well, where do I want to position myself so that I am noticed or so that I have the skill set to later try other areas and to test myself? So on Friday's show, maybe we'll go through the six leadership styles that we can all take quizzes to see where we might perform best.
We're going to get out of here now, but you'll notice he spoke of his father-in-law only and not his dad. Yeah. We'll get to that later at home.
That's going to be a pop-up episode.
Yeah, we'll come back with jingles and we'll come back with the email. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Haven't heard this in a while.
Is this Chicago?
No.
You make me so very happy.
No. Blood, sweat, and tears.
Oh, yeah, I can't stand
David Clayton Thomas.
Can't stand them either.
You lost it many times before. Threw coffee creamer across the floor. Waiting in checkout lines is such a chore. Your vituperation shows. Oh, when discussing errant drones, don't get you started on the purple line, because it makes you lose your mind. We like to listen when you're unhappy. It's quite hard to explain this to my wife.
The great Brad Weiss.
That's terrific.
That's
professor
good,
at William & Mary, professor of anthropology.
Professor, that's all right.
Sort of surprised we didn't have a Caps Choking jingle, but maybe tomorrow.
Before we get into the mailbag, I want to say thank you to Howard of the Huff Post. It's written here, Huffington yes. Post, but that's long
and
gone.
Also consultant to The President Show, which is hilarious, and it's on Comedy Central every Thursday night at 11:30.
So I don't have to make room for the plug because Howard just did it.
I did it. I wanted to seize my moment.
Get on, and 3DP, yeah.
I'd also like to thank the sponsors, SeatGeek, MeUndies, and ZipRecruiter. Please support them the way they support the podcast. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of The Tony Kornheiser Show wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, that's new, Spotify, and Google Play. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to the show through iTunes, please leave a review. So there's a lot of places that you can listen to this. I'd like to read this under the headline of Melancholy Happy Trails, and this is going to mean more to me than to almost anybody else. This is from Herman Yam in Ashburn. Dear Mr. Tony, 30 years ago you wrote an April Fool's cover story for the Washington Post magazine about the Washington Senators and their prospects for the 1987 Major League Baseball season, and I remember that very, very well. Team owner and Yugo car dealer Tang Yilin was portrayed by Frederick Sau, a longtime China Airlines executive whose sons I became friends with in high school and college. Mr. Sau passed away in his sleep at age 75 at the home of his eldest son, Alex, on April 20th of this year after an illness. At the memorial service on April 30th, Fred's younger son, Byron, eulogized his father, mentioning Fred's appearance in your article as a highlight of his father's long, loving, and generous life. I thought you might like to know that your work has meaning that endures.
That's nice.
Very, very nice to hear. From Matt Santanapola. I'm a general contractor in Boston, and I tell all my clients the same thing. I can build what you want correct, on time, or for cheap, and you pick two of the three. And that's what's happened to me. Sue Meyer, Ponte Vedra Beach. My husband is a photographer for the PGA, so this week he's at the Players. He texted the following to me. In the lunchroom with your cheesery guy, obviously Sands. Good thing I was there because he was trapped until I told him to push the exit button next to the door to get out. I think the Golf Channel guys with him were just happy he didn't slam right into the door and ruin that TV-ready smile of his. I asked him why he didn't get me an autograph, but he said saving Sands' credibility should be enough. And it also ends, Michael, if you want a tea time, let me know. From Keegan Liff in Cumming, Georgia. I'm emailing to make sure that Chessie is okay and in good health. With all the choking dogs in D.C. last night, I wanted to be sure that Chessie, too, did not choke like the rest of the city. On a lighter note, the D.C. United are 3-4-2, so that's worth something, right? Yeah.
Stephen Birnbaum in here earlier.
He was in here earlier.
D.C. United.
Stephen Louisville writes, I love it when Luke Russert is on the show. He sounds exactly like my own kids, ages 20, 18, and 16, who are also spoiled rotten. Middle seat, yeah, right. Reminds me of the family vacation. Good times. Good times. From Andy in Jersey City, after listening to the show yesterday, I too have grave concerns for Matt Harvey, who, as Luke astutely points out, only made $14 million in his career. Professional sports are an unforgiving mistress, and if he doesn't shape up soon, young Mr. Harvey could quickly find himself joining millions of other Americans who suffer with the uncertainty and anxiety associated with finding yourself unemployed, sitting courtside at Wizards playoff games, guest hosting podcasts, cuddling with koala bear, middle seats on flights, and trips around the world are just some of the daily humiliations that the unemployed in this country face every single day. Don't think it can't happen to you. This is just so great.
Funny.
From David Brown, here's what I imagine a conversation between Luke Russert and Matt Harvey sounds like. Luke, wow, this Brooklyn gastro pub is hopping. Matt, you bet. You want a drink? I'm buying. Luke, you're buying? You've only made $14 million. What are you going to get us? A couple of glasses of Kendall Jackson? Matt, it's really not that bad. Luke, yeah, if the Exxon station's all out of premium unleaded, Matt, hey, try and flag down the waitress, would you, Luke? Why bother? The service here is awful. I might as well be trying to board a Southwest flight without a group number on my ticket. Nobody cares about the consumer anymore. Matt, you know, I'm getting tired. We have a 1 p.m. game tomorrow. Luke, and another thing, if you ever meet someone who brags about winning an Emmy, tell them they're as worthless as that piece of garbage award, which any monkey in a suit could win. Matt, okay, I'm going to get a cab. Luke, good luck. Caps fans are probably clocking up the traffic from here to Montauk. Matt, but we're in New York. Luke, burn it all down, brother. Burn it to the ground. It's just fantastic. Peter Stapor writes, Caps down 2-0 with 6 minutes left. Brooks Like would have never let this happen. He was didn't everybody, the cheese boy, write constantly that he was the most important person in the history of the franchise?
Brooks Like, soul of the team.
Brooks, is that what he was?
I have no clue.
They missed him last night.
Well, yes. You think they choked?
Yes.
Okay.
They choked.
You think I'm too kind?
I'm the deciding vote here. I'm the deciding vote here. They choked.
If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
Not red.
Honestly, what the f*** are we doing here?
take my chances, or will you ride me back? Another shot at destiny for 50 cents a line. Well, I can't keep this underground. I gotta make you mine. Stops was about the